The following lectures were given by Paul Marshall, April 18 through 19, 2008, in Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Marshall is Senior Fellow of the Center for Religious Freedom, Hudson Institute, Washington, D.C. Dr. Marshall is the author and editor of over 20 books on religion and politics, especially religious freedom, including more recently, Religious Freedom in the World and Radical Islam's Rules, the Worldwide Spread of Extreme Sharia Law. This address is titled, The Roots of Terrorism.
I was in a debate in New York on Tuesday evening. There's a foundation which is funding different debates every month. And this was a debate on, is Islam dominated by radicals? The team I was on was the people arguing in favor of the motion, that is, that Islam is dominated by radicals. We won. In fact, they take a vote before for, you know, what the audience thinks about it, and you take a vote afterwards. So the question of winning isn't just whether most people voted for you, because maybe 90% of them agreed with you at the start, but how many switches you get. So we won by the biggest switch. But anyway, that debate will be carried on NPR. Check your local listings, but you may be or may not be interested in that. So that would also indicate for you that while I think I've argued strenuously that most Muslims are not radicals, in terms of the organized power structure and the direction Islam is going right now, we are seeing a radicalization. Radical Islam and terrorism, they're not necessarily the same thing. You could be a radical Muslim, but not blow people up. So the terrorists are yet a wing of them. But the more radical ideologies we see, I would like to concentrate it on exploring those in this final session, because that's one of the major reasons that we are interested in Islam. We should have been interested in Islam far earlier than now. Now it has got our attention. As was mentioned last night, Ambrose Bierce saying, war is God's way of teaching Americans geography. War has become our means of trying to deal with this. Here I'm looking at Islamist terrorism. Again, bear in mind there are many other forms of terrorism throughout the world, in Colombia with the FLN, amongst the Basques, the Tamil Tigers, and so forth. Focusing on the most widespread movement and the most dangerous movement, because if it can, it will explode nuclear weapons. That whole network of Islamist terrorist groups, which we now use the umbrella term Al-Qaeda for, doesn't seem to be an organization anymore, but a more diffuse network, a franchise, if you will, and then other groups which aren't violent but have similar goals. Other groups like Hizb ut-Tahrir out of Central Asia, the Muslim Brotherhood, probably the most influential Muslim movement these days. So that's what I'll talk about. Let's put aside some wrong or misleading or distorted or insufficient explanations of the growth of radicalism in Islam. Here I want to quote from a column by Mark Stein of October 4th, 2001, that is about 3 to 4 weeks after the attacks of September 11th, 2001. He makes the point about many of our vacuous explanations, except he makes it in a very funny way. Stein says, what have we learned since September 11th? We've learned that poverty breeds despair, despair breeds instability, instability breeds resentment, and resentment breeds extremism. Yes, folks, these are what we in the trade call, quote, root causes. Which cause do you root for? Then follows large numbers of quotations. Poverty breeds instability, the Detroit News. Or poverty breeds fanaticism, the San Francisco Chronicle. Or instability breeds zealots, the Toronto Globe and Mail. Or fanaticism breeds hatred. Or hatred breeds extremism, the Romanian Foreign Minister. Desperation breeds resentment, the Los Angeles Times. Despair breeds terrorism, the San Diego Union Tribune. Or others say that injustice breeds hopelessness, or hopelessness breeds fanaticism, or injustice breeds rage. Or ignorance breeds hate. Hostility, these are all quotes from newspapers. Hostility breeds violence. Suffering breeds violence. War breeds hate, and hate breeds terrorism. Anger breeds anger, hostility breeds hostility. Attacks are going to breed other attacks, and altogether now, violence breeds violence. And Stein remarks, breeders, breeders everywhere. A large swathe of Western elites has settled into an endless dopey roundelay, a vast Schnitzlerian carousel where every abstract noun is carrying on like Anthony Quinn on Viagra. Stein's own comment on this, he says, well, this is what I think. Instability breeds resentment. Resentment breeds inertia. Inertia breeds generalities. Generalities breed clichés. Clichés breed lame metaphors until we reach the pitiful state were to modify the old eyewitness news formula, if it breeds, it leads. These sorts of comments, this sort of universalized thing of one abstract noun breeds another abstract noun, are almost totally vacuous and not particularly helpful. Also, if for the beginning I'm going to focus on terrorism, and again I want to emphasize I don't mean all radical Muslims are terrorists, I just mean they have radical goals, we should also not think the terrorists or indeed other radical groups are poor. They're generally not. They're usually from middle class to upper middle class backgrounds, occasionally higher. Zawahiri is an Egyptian from a very sort of distinguished Egyptian family, a medical doctor by profession. Osama bin Laden is, of course, the son of one of the wealthiest families in the world. When you get attacked by a multimillionaire, it's not a good idea to attribute it to their poverty. Obviously, you can get lower-level soldiers, so to speak, recruit them from amongst the poor. But generally, the profile of terrorist attackers is usually fairly successful. We see this in England with the attempted subway bombings and others. And the last one, the people have not been convicted, so I need to be careful, but what is called the doctor's plot. The latest terrorism, major terrorism attack in England, the various people involved were medical doctors. Relating this to poverty and suffering is a mistake. The really poor places in the world are places like Mozambique or Haiti. They're not producing terrorists. Nor should we think the terrorist groups or radical groups more simply ignorant, either ignorant, uneducated in general, or ignorant of the West. They're not. The more a Muslim is educated in the West, the more likely they are to be a terrorist. The likelihood is very low in both cases. If you look at profiles of terrorists, comparatively few that grew up in Waziristan, lived in their village and then went off to be that. Usually, almost by definition, they're people who've moved around a lot and often moved around in the West. To quote some of these, Hassan al-Turabi, the major sort of ideological leader for many years of Islam in the Sudan, has advanced degrees in law from the University of London and from the Sorbonne. Abbasi Madani, the leader of Algeria's Islamic Salvation Front, has a doctorate in education from the University of London. Musa Abu Mazak, the head of Hamas's political committee, has a doctorate in engineering from Louisiana Tech University. Similarly, perhaps the single major influential ideologue of radical Islam, the Egyptian Sayyid Qutb, major ideologue of the Muslim Brotherhood, became radicalized in the United States. He was a sort of a more liberal Muslim, though radicalizing a little in Egypt, was deeply involved in education. For that reason, was sent by the Egyptian government to the United States. He was here for a period of almost 2 years to study the administration of higher education. And he got radicalized by what he saw as the corruption and decadence in the United States, particularly as he experienced it at a Methodist church dance in Greeley, Colorado. He lived in Greeley, Colorado, small town, America, 1948-1949. Went back and committed radical. A striking incident, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, regarded as the operational mastermind of the 9/11 attacks on the United States. He was captured in Pakistan 3 to 4 years ago, still in detention. Do you know where he studied? He studied at a few places, but well, he studied at a Baptist college in North Carolina. It's not that these people don't know us. Often they do. They may have a disjointed view. If you're a student in a foreign country, not comfortable with the language, it can be very marginal. It can be very alienating. It's one reason work with foreign students is so important. The idea that, you know, this is all a misunderstanding, that if they really knew us, they'd like us. The ones who tend to know us more often tend to like us less. Not all of them. Most Muslims who come over here sort of really like the United States and often want to stay. We are being attacked by people who in several respects are very modern. They draw on Islam. The ideology, if I use that word, is definitely draws on strands of Islam. To say it has nothing to do with Islam is simply stupid or meaningless. But there's a way in which they're modern. They're not sort of traditional Muslims. They're exposed to the West. They're interested in organization and planning. They develop their view of Islam less like a faith and more like an ideology. It's a program. And things are stripped away from it. So in that sense, they have become modernized. Other factors we should look at, these are all sociological factors we're considering right now, is the question of what we call globalization. It's a word we've all heard, it's a word we all use. It's a meaningful word, though it's very hard to say precisely what the meaning is. Globalization is very hard to really pin down and give a precise definition. That shouldn't worry us, it is pointing to something real. It's something like the integration of the world in terms of markets, of where we buy and sell, and especially communication. The world is getting smaller. Contra Friedman, I don't think it's getting flatter, but it's certainly getting smaller. We notice this now. A Danish newspaper publishes cartoons, and 35 churches are burnt down in Nigeria. There are many reasons for this, including an increased radicalization. 40 years ago, if a Danish newspaper in Copenhagen published these cartoons, nobody in Nigeria would know about it, or in Pakistan. But now they do. It used to be the case that in terms of Islamic legal doctrine, again, law is central within Islam, you didn't particularly worry about what the infidels did, where the infidels lived. Muslims living in Syria didn't worry if somebody in Germany in the 1500s said something negative about Muhammad. One obvious reason is, of course, you wouldn't know about it. But even if they did, they said, well, they're infidels. That's what infidels do. That's why they're infidels. Now, if they came into your back garden and your territory, the realm of Islam, and did it, that would be different. With the world being smaller, you do hear about it. So everything we do is public. The temptation now is to try and, you know, deal with issues around the world and exact punishment all around the world. So that Van Gogh, the Dutch documentary director who produced with Hersey Ali that short documentary on the status of women in Islam called Submission, was stabbed to death in the street in Amsterdam. In fact, he was almost beheaded. Many people in the West now live with bodyguards. There are modernist elements, Islamic radicals, which you didn't get within traditional culture. Globalization has one effect, that they know about what we're doing and saying and thinking. And they know it in another way, that there is what is perceived as a cultural invasion. As you know, many of the French get upset because of the appearance of McDonald's in France, French Disneyland. The response to that is, well, the French hate McDonald's. Why is McDonald's doing so well in France? If you don't like it, don't go. But there are other exports, particularly our culture and communications. The most popular TV program for a while in Iran, Baywatch. Two things in this. One is, shows an awful lot of Iranians, while denouncing this, turn out to watch it. But again, if you check Saudi chat rooms, what goes on in the internet cafe and the Matawa, the religious police do, high proportion of it is visits to pornographic websites. But you get two reactions. One is the temptation you want to see this. The other one, and you say, in the end, look, they're hypocritical, they're doing it. Who's producing this stuff? We are. Movies, TVs, books are looked at in many parts of the Muslim world. And here I'm not just talking about terrorists. And here I'm not just talking about radicals, I'm talking about any old average Muslim. This is a lot of their experience with the West. These are the cultural experts. And they equate that with Christianity. What does Christianity bring you? Booze and loose women. And that's very much the picture you get. Or clothing, or other things like this. That is a factor. And that's seen as an assault on both womanhood and manhood in much of the Muslim world. Both women are seen to be degraded, and one of the roles of men is to protect women, and then you're undercut in doing that. That is a major factor in radicalization. It's not capitalism in the sense of, you know, we're having this trade, that and the other, but it's the cultural impact, which is understood to be extremely threatening. And our cultural impact has several dimensions, things to do with the status of women and other things, but it's undeniable that it has major negative things. We, this is now, quote, Western civilization, are promulgating a lot of horrible things throughout the world. And many Muslims are reacting against that and feel tremendously threatened by it. Some of what they react to, I think they're wrong. Others of which they react to, my response is, yep, me too. And bear in mind, this is a problem in terms of perception of what Christianity is amongst many Muslims. So we need to overcome that. Let me also say, in terms of understanding Islamic radicalism, it can go up or down. You can have anger in terms of US policy or Israeli policy or things of this kind. But that's not really a foundational factor. The attacks on US on 9/11 took 2 years to plan. So they were started planning that in President Clinton's seventh year. Or you can go back to the bombings of the Marine barracks and so on in the early 1980s, or attacks on USS Cole, or the blowing up of U.S. embassies in East Africa. This has been going on quite a while. If you look at the key movements in this, you'll find their roots in the 1920s. Islamic radical is not due to the fact they all hate George Bush, or that they all hated Bill Clinton, or whatever. That could drive the thermometer up and down, but the root phenomena we're dealing with goes back quite a bit earlier, and I relate that to some of our comments yesterday. We can't understand the dynamics of radical Islam or of terrorism without looking at its explicitly religious dimension. For someone like bin Laden, they're engaged in a religious war. That doesn't mean we should be engaged in a religious war. But it's very important for us to understand that that's what they think they are involved in it. They want to impose their version of Islam on the Muslim world. Take over some territory, make that a base. Al-Qaeda means at the base. And then try to take over more of the Muslim world to bring it together as the Ummah, the Muslim people, under one caliph. Essentially, to get back to that. To continue the expansion which existed before. So if you look at that first 1,000 years of that expansion up until the 16th or 17th century, that was the good times when Muslims were pure and true. We've fallen on hard times because we're unfaithful. So what do we need to do? We need to get back to the good times. Pure, faithful Muslims. Get rid of all these accretions, these foreign, these infidel ideas we've taken on. Get rid of those. Go back to pure Islam. Restore the Muslim community. Carry on the program of the first 1,000 years, and essentially take over the world. Also note, if you're a religious revivalist movement, which at one level these movements are, they're trying to restore, revive, change the nature of Islam. If you've ever been involved in a religious revivalist movement, you'll know who's your biggest problem. Well, it's all the people inside your religion who won't get with the program. And you try and persuade them, you preach to them, this still continues. And at a certain point, if they don't get with it, you force them to do it under threat of death, or you kill them. A central part of the movement is either to persuade Muslims to get with these programs, or if they won't be persuaded, simply force them to do it. But here, there's some quotations now from bin Laden as to how he sees what he's engaged in. This is from his 1998 Al Jazeera interview, his longest single thing. There are two parties to this conflict. World Christianity, allied with the Jews and Zionism, led by the United States, Britain, and Israel. The second party is the Islamic world. He has many other things, repeated refrain. This is a religious war. It says, those who deny this, deny this plain text of Islam. They refuse to face reality. This is a religious war, and religious terms should be used to describe it so the truth is revealed. This is a religious war. The truth is that Bush has raised the banner of the cross high and fights for it. That's how he sees things. Casey says similar things about Vladimir Putin, too, in terms of defending them. To their view, it's a religious conflict to restore proper place of Islam in the modern world. Remember why that needs restoring. From this map last night, looking at the boundaries of the Muslim world in 1600-1700, and then by the 1920s, having only as independent Afghanistan, Iran, Turkey, and the Arabian Peninsula, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen. And these three didn't count. And then 1924, the caliphate is abolished. This is the low point in the Muslim world. In terms of measures of democracy, in terms of measures of human rights, in terms of measures of religious freedom, much of the Muslim world falls pretty near the bottom, especially the Middle Eastern world, especially the Arab world. Outside of the Arab world, measures for Muslims are quite a bit higher. So you've had this sort of military defeat being taken over by others. Now you have nominal independence, but you feel weak. Governments are repressive. Human rights are awful. Economically, things are also bad. There are exceptions. Malaysia is a successful country. Turkey does doing pretty well. And then, of course, you have the very wealthy oil countries, Kuwait, Bahrain, and so forth, to some degree Saudi Arabia. But in much of the Muslim world, if you don't have oil, you're desperately poor. So in terms of many of the measures used in the Muslim world, that is those countries where Muslims are a majority, is not doing well. So there's tremendous fear, there's tremendous shame, humiliation, and again the question, why is this? Why are we such a mess once we were so strong, when we were powerful? This is what is drawn upon in radicals. The promise, this is, why do we have problems? Well, because we are unfaithful, but also that the infidels have pushed this on us. Somebody else did it. So there's a tremendous sense of blaming all those except ourselves for our problem, and then suggesting that the way to get back to what we were, the way once more to be powerful, the way to be glorious, is to have true Islam. The problem is not that we have failed because we didn't imitate the West, that we didn't learn enough about technology or science or rational thinking or criticism or freedom of speech or freedom of religion or an open society, and that those things somehow breed the modern world, but that we have taken up too much of that, and that has corrupted us, that has weakened us, that's what's destroyed us. We need to get rid of those things and get back to a pure Islam. I'll just outline briefly four of the movements which push this idea very strongly. Many of them, particularly in the Sunni world, have their origins in the 1920s. It's, again, as I say, in many ways, within Islam is a pivotal decade. That's the low point in modern history. Things are bad now, but perhaps they were worse then, in that for most Muslims were simply subject peoples. They were subject peoples to Christians. The three movements which I mentioned, the ones who believe that the failure of the Muslim world is rooted in the unfaithfulness of Muslims, and want to restore Islam to the purity of the faith as it existed with the life of Muhammad, in the time of Muhammad, and his immediate followers. These four are the Wahhabi movement. You can spell that W-A-H-A-B-I, or you can put two H's in there. There's no standardized English spelling of Arabic words. The Muslim Brotherhood, springing largely from Egypt. The Jamaat-e-Islami, springing from India, Pakistan, and radical Shiites, which comes later, which one finds in the regime in Iran. The Wahhabis, this is the official version of Islam in Saudi Arabia. also to some degree in Bahrain and other places, but they managed to be far more casual about it. This movement is called Wahhabis by those who don't like it. They hate being called Wahhabis, by the way. Being yelled at by the Saudi ambassador on this score. No, we're just sort of Muslims. And Wahhabis makes you look like a sect, a follower of a particular man, rather than just true, pure, Salafi, originalist Muslims. So they don't like the term, which is one reason I like to use it. The reason for this is the form of Islam you find in Arabia has always been very strict or reactionary. One, because it's the heartland of Islam. Secondly, outside of the cities of Mecca and Medina, out in the desert itself, they are tribespeople. For a long time, almost untouched by outside influences, have the qualities of tribal cultures, very traditionalist, very honor-bound, very resistant to outside influences. So Islam in Arabia has always been of the most conservative and reactionary kind. Wahhab found even this version of Islam, he thought it was hopelessly corrupt. Decided that Islam everywhere needed reform, starting with Arabia. He opposed every religious practice not explicitly laid down in the Quran and the Hadith. Particularly, he opposed to the Sufis with their lodges and the other things. He thought they were very corrupt. He objected to Muslims having grave sites. You might know that the Saudis have been destroying all the historical archaeological monuments to do with Islam, like Muhammad's house. Muhammad's house is now a parking lot, multi-level parking lot. Why? Because Muslims were going to the house, and it was a fear that this could become an object of idolatry. And then Sufis and others have saints, and they visit the saints' graves. So the idea is the graves must be unmarked, so people do not know where they are, lest they lead to idolatry. So you overcome idolatry by removing everything which could possibly be idolized. This is a theme with Wahhab. While there have always been conflicts between Muslims, Wahhab was unusually eager to attack other Muslims who he thought were not sufficiently pious. This major, major emphasis on the unity of God that we mentioned before. Nothing should be put near God or could be confused with God and destroy everything which could be a possible competitor to God's role. So that other Muslims who had grave sites or had saints and whatever, they either had to give them up or he'd kill them. So Wahhab and his followers were unusual in that they kept denouncing other Muslims as non-Muslims. That's fairly unusual in Islamic history. You could call somebody else a bad Muslim if they were not really living properly. But you wouldn't call them a non-Muslim. Of course they're a Muslim. They're just not a very good Muslim. But then to say of people who professed to be Muslims and said, yes, I am a Muslim. I believe in God. I believe in the Prophet. To say they're not Muslims. Therefore, they're apostates and they should be killed. Others had done this before, but never with such zeal and never with such pervasiveness. In 1745, Wahhab, as a spiritual leader and imam, formed an alliance with a tribal leader, a tribal family, whose name you probably know. This was the Saud clan, from which we get the modern term Saudi Arabia. The area is called Arabia. The Saud is the name of the family. It's a country named after a ruling family. And they formed an alliance that the Saud family said they would help propagate Wahhabism. The Wahhabis said they would justify and give the legitimacy for the Saud family. So they took over a large portion of Saudi Arabia by force of arms. Went up as far north into Iraq. I think Wahhab was in Basra at one point. And they came out of the desert in the middle, but actually took over Mecca and Medina. The area they're from was the area called the Najd, here, right in the middle. It's desert. I mean, it's pretty bleak, it's pretty tough. The people who live there were pretty bleak and pretty tough. But anyway, they managed to come and take over the cities, which they regarded as corrupt, of Mecca and Medina. At that point got the attention of the Ottomans. Remember, the Ottoman Turks were running this whole area at the time, and decided that the Wahhabis were getting out of control, ended that by massacring them in large numbers. So the Wahhabis continued in the desert for a while. And then, to some level, history repeated itself. Wahhabism was a fairly obscure sect in the Arabian desert. However, in the 1920s, in the aftermath of the First World War, it illustrates this, though it doesn't explain it, if you ever see the movie Lawrence of Arabia. The British didn't quite promise, but hinted at, that, remember in the First World War, the British and others were fighting the Germans, the Austro-Hungarians, and the Ottomans, and the Arabs were ruled by the Ottomans. So part of it is, well, if you help us, and Brit said, if you help us in your fight against them, you can get independence from the Ottomans. And so the Arab revolt, backed by the British did in fact give them independence from the Ottomans, but actually not independence from the British. And that's why Lawrence of Arabia felt betrayed and so on. This history is interwoven with that. With the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, there was something of a vacuum. And at this point, the Saud family decided again to come charging out of the desert and also to take over Mecca and Medina, kicked out the current rulers, whose family now runs Jordan, the then current rulers, and again in alliance with the Wahhabis. The Saudis would back the Wahhabis would back the Saud family, and essentially they took over the vast majority of the Arabian Peninsula. This would give them prestige in that it's, so to speak, the Holy Land, has the two holy shrines in Mecca and Medina. Still, it would have remained fairly obscure, except if you're a Muslim, that part of the world didn't mean much. It was poor, it was desert. And then something else happened. The world's largest oil reserves were discovered. And suddenly, an obscure desert sheikhdom became very wealthy, has now become something of a world power. The world's largest oil reserves, and the world's largest, I think just ahead of Russia, the world's largest exporter of oil. Saudi Arabia, by dint of its wealth, now becomes an arbiter of the Muslim world. And they mentioned the amount of money they spend. They increased it when Khomeini took over Iran. The Saudis bumped up the amount they were spending. Because remember, the Shiites are a rival, the Shiites are heretics. When Khomeini took over Iran, this was provoked a lot of fear and worry in Saudi Arabia. It was a competitor, so they bumped up their amount of money then. The Saudis have also since taken to declaring themselves, and I've heard this directly from the ambassador, as the Muslim Vatican. Say, why are you doing all this sort of stuff around the world? The major Muslim centers of learning, you know, used to be Damascus and Cairo and other places. Saudi Arabia's place where the shrines were, but it wasn't the country was meaningless. The title of the Saudi king, the guardian of the two holy shrines, and now also saying they're the Muslim Vatican, which, as you probably know, is a very un-Muslim expression. Not just the Vatican part, but in Sunni Islam, it was very decentralized. Religiously, within Islam, you could never find out who was in charge. You know, there are all sorts of positions. It was very consensual and discussive. It would be like, you know, someone coming in and says, well, who's in charge of Protestants? Says, well, there isn't one. You know, Billy Graham was influential, but, you know, people don't like. And Sunni Islam was like that. Whoever might have been seen as number one, it wasn't the Saudis. And now they're pushing to make themselves sort of the official arbiter of Sunni Islam. And they got the money to do it. We talked a bit about how they're spreading that. Wahhabi influence is growing throughout the world. There's a more radical form of Islam. It's producing conflict in many parts of the world. Wahhabi influence is also quite strong in the United States. Not amongst individual Muslims, but more so amongst the mosques and Muslim organizations. disproportionate influence of Gulf money. One also sees this worryingly in the educational establishment. Frank Vogel at Harvard Law School is the guardian of the two shrines professor of Islamic law at Harvard. The Saudis having given $20 million to Harvard for programs on Islam, another $20 million, of course, to Georgetown to fund the Center for Muslim Christian Understanding, and millions elsewhere. A recent report by the British government said that in terms of Islamic studies programs in the United Kingdom, more money is spent on this by private donors than is by the British government. Private donors is a euphemism for, I don't think they mean Hamid, who's running the grocery store around the corner. It's coming out of the Gulf, and I don't mean it's all negative. The Emirates, Abu Dhabi, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwaitis also donate money. One wants to be careful with it, but they're much nicer than the Saudis. But nevertheless, the influence of Saudi money, Saudi imams, is not only in other parts of the Muslim world, but also in North America and also in Europe. It is very worrying. So that's one influence. Wahhabis from Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden is an offshoot of this. And his family originally from Yemen, down here, but now essentially Saudi. This border didn't really exist. In practical terms, it still doesn't exist. Osama, we call him a Saudi. Osama, his home area is the Hadramaut Valley down here in Yemen. So again, Wahhabi Islam is very reactionary. One sees this in its textbooks. We produced two studies of their textbooks. And again, by radical, I don't mean all the Saudis are terrorists and blowing people up. But with that very reactionary form of ideology, it's out of that background that terrorists do come. And that's Osama bin Laden's background. Another movement is the Muslim Brotherhood. If you go back to the 1920s, the Muslim world, the Muslim heartland, is under European or infidel or Christian control. This is a low point. The British are more or less running Egypt. Within Egypt, at this point, a man, Hassan al-Banna, began a movement whose name we now translate as the Muslim Brotherhood. He founded that in 1928. It was essentially a reform organization. It was educational. It emphasized piety, prayer, going to the mosque, education, discipline, athletics, honesty, wanting to reform the sort of lawyers, the doctors, pushing people in business. So almost a movement, across the board movement for moral renewal, with the first not too much of an explicit political program, though that began to develop after a decade. The Muslim Brotherhood core group was in Egypt, but it rapidly spread to other countries. Qutb himself was killed in 1948. The Brotherhood developed violent offshoots who attacked the government, and partly in retaliation, Qutb was killed by the Egyptian government in 1948. His effective successor, there were a couple of other people, was the person I mentioned earlier, Sayyid Qutb, who in 1948 is on his way to the United States to take up residence in Greeley, Colorado. He thought the Methodist church dance was so corrupt. Qutb went back and became the sort of chief theorist or ideologue of the Brotherhood, wrote voluminously, was in and out of prison. And again, he argued that the Muslim world had become so corrupt it wasn't really Muslim anymore. It was now like the world, the state the world was in when Muhammad came. It's Jahiliya, a realm of sort of chaos and corruption, and we need to start again. So we have to renew Islam. The Brotherhood continued to produce violent offshoots. Some tried to kill Nasser when he took over in Egypt. 1954, Nasser banned the organizations and Qutb himself was killed in 1966. The Brotherhood was banned at one level, it's still banned in Egypt. As a political movement, it's banned. You cannot have a religiously based political movement in Egypt by law. But the Brotherhood continues. Everybody knows it's the main opposition. If you want to go and interview a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, there's no problem doing so. So it's a semi-legal, semi-illegal organization kept in a box by the Egyptian government. Within Egypt, with frustration that they couldn't get anywhere peacefully, you had offshoots which were violent. One of these offshoots was Islamic Jihad, whose leader you may have heard of, Ayman al-Zawahiri. That's his background. It's often said of Al-Qaeda that the Saudis provide the money and the muscles, but the Egyptians provide the brains. It's the Egyptians that say that, but other people agree with that. Another offshoot was Jamaat, or Gamaat Islamiya, another violent group. By the way, these are the people, Islamic Jihad, the people who killed Sadat, the Egyptian president, in 1981. Jamaat Islamiya, another violent group. Its leader was Sheikh Abdul Rahman, who is now in prison in the United States for his role in organizing and pushing for the first attack on the World Trade Center. The Muslim Brotherhood, in many ways, is the most influential, certainly the most influential radical organization. It has offshoots throughout the world. The largest group is in Egypt, but amongst the Palestinians, Hamas is the Muslim Brotherhood amongst the Palestinians. The Muslim Brotherhood also has groupings in Lebanon, in Syria, though Sadat Senior, the father of the current president, massacred many of them, and effectively squashed them. It's strong in Jordan, in the Jordanian parliament, and throughout the Arab world, also in Sudan. At one level, the current Sudanese regime, one of its constituent parts is the Muslim Brotherhood. The Radical Islamic Party in Indonesia is a Brotherhood offshoot. Many of the Muslim organizations you will find in Europe and the United States are Muslim Brotherhood offshoots. Groups like CUR, the Council on American Islamic Relations, is one. A major grouping of mosques in America, ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America, is also a Brotherhood offshoot. It is a highly influential organization and has a radical ideology. Again, I'm not saying it's a terrorist ideology. It's produced terrorist groups, as I've mentioned. It is a radical ideology, and the U.S. government right now is debating whether to have official conversations with the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood on the grounds that it will probably take over Egypt at some point. A third radical movement, I'm just taking what I think are the three most influential Sunni ones and one Shiite one, is usually translated Jamaat-e-Islami. And again, the spelling can vary. This would be an Urdu formulation rather than an Arabic one, but it's a variation in Arabic. You would note the word Jamaat appearing. That just means group, organization. It's a sort of generic term. Islami, obviously, most of these things translate as the Islamic group, the Islamic organization. They're fairly generic ones. The founder of this organization was a man, Maulana Maududi. Usual spelling of Maududi, M-A-U-D-U-D-I. Born 1903, died, I think, 1979. That meant, when he was growing up, he was within British India. You know, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and India were one territory ruled by the British. And there were obviously major independence movements coming up. India at this time trying to get the British out. Maududi objected to that. He maintained, as many radical Islamists do, that nationalism is un-Islamic. Why should the political organization be a group of people you call a nation or share a language? That violates Islam. Islam is the organizing principle. The idea is Muslims comprise a political entity. It's not that Egyptians do it, or it's not that Iranians do it, or it's not that Pashtuns do it. Who cares about that? I mean, for language and other things, it's important. nationalism, like democracy, is inherently anti-Islamic. So he divorced himself from Indian independence, even from the Muslim movement pushing for independence, and argued that the only true form of Islam is having an Islamic state, and shaped a lot of thinking amongst radical Muslim movements in India, a school often referred to, already existed, but he reshaped it, the Deobandi movement, D-E-O-B-A-N-D-I, the Deobandis. That's another term you will see coming around. A lot of the radical movements in Pakistan, after the division he went to live in Pakistan, a lot of the radical movements and the major umbrella radical movement within Pakistan is Jamaat-e-Islami and has Maududi's influence. There's comparatively few Pakistani immigrants into the United States, but they're very important in England, in Britain. If you're looking at radicalization in Britain, you're not usually looking to the Muslim Brotherhood, though it operates there, or to the Wahhabis, but to these Pakistani groups and Deobandi schools. And here, all these things are schools with many people involved, but if you wanted to pick one person who was influential in this, that was Maududi. And again, he born 1903, but most of his writing again comes in the 1920s. When the question throughout the Muslim world is, where do we go from here? And all these competing ideologies come in. So those are three of the major, and there are many minor ones, Sunni schools. Of course, we've had the appearance of a Shiite school. The Shahs in ruling Iran in the 20th century were not as secular as Ataturk in Turkey, but still relatively secular. They emphasized not Islam, but Iranian nationalism, the ancient history of Islam. Cyrus the Great would be a great person, and so forth. And many Muslims in Iran saw this as basically un-Islamic and wanted to get rid of this regime. Many movements, a key figure is a name you would recognize, the Ayatollah Khomeini, born 1902. Notice all these guys, 1902, 1903, where they come up. He criticized the rulers for being corrupt and anti-Islamic. He was in and out of prison. He then went off to Iraq and taught in Najaf. Iraq being, until the development of modern Iran, the heartland, the theoretical heartland, the scholarly heartland of the Shiites is, of course, southern Iraq, Karbala, Najaf. Places like Qum were not really that central. So Khomeini went to Najaf, was there for a while, got kicked out of there by Saddam Hussein as a favor to the Iranians, and then went and lived in Paris. But had a similar, of course, his own Shiite particularities, but the overall ideology of the place of Islam in the world and the domination by foreign infidel powers, especially the great Satan, that's us, us in this context being Americans, not particularly Christians, though he wouldn't distinguish, and seen as the great Satan, the Russians, of course, the lesser Satan. Bear in mind, within Islam, Satan is particularly the seducer, the tempter. The great Satan is not so much someone who comes, you know, flaming in the night to kill you, but the one who seduces you. So the image of America as the Satan goes back to some of those cultural things that we mentioned earlier. But anyway, to cut a long story short, the Shah began to get weaker and weaker, and Khomeini came back in triumph and took over the country, which was a complete surprise to the CIA. One gentleman I know, who's, I'm getting tired, his name escapes me, it will come back. He has a very good chapter in the book by Doug Johnston, who some of you would know, on religion and diplomacy. And he recounts how when there was all this activity in the late 1970s in Iran, it looked like the Shah might be weak. The analysts in the CIA and the State Department said, well, the Shah has the sort of army, the navy, he's got the military on board, the elite political classes, the merchants seem to be on board, basically all the relevant political power structures defend him. So while there's all this sort of demonstrations and stuff, he will be secure. I mean, the opposition just seems to be coming from these sort of religious types. One suggestion was made to the CIA that they should study the ideas of these religious types. The idea was turned down on the grounds that it would be, and I quote, mere sociology, which is intelligence speak for irrelevant academic verbiage, which, to be fair to the CIA, is a good description of sociology. But in this case, again, another story that religion was simply not taken seriously. That's not important, it's just a religious thing. And they were really surprised. That's why the embassy was taken over. Do you ever wonder, why wasn't the embassy empty? You know, when there's a million people in the streets shouting death to the great Satan, and you're the great Satan, usually what you do is like evacuate at least non-essential personnel. It didn't. And the Iranians also got most of the secret documents. They weren't destroyed. I mean, this is quite serious. Why? Because many people in the U.S. government didn't and still don't see religion as a significant factor in world affairs. Excuse me for the commercial break in the... But Khomeini took over. That's a very unusual regime in many ways. It's, to some degree, its model is Plato's Republic. If you've read that, you have the Guardian, you have the Guardian Council, and others. It's unusual in many respects, but one of this is that within Shiism, you had the ruler, and then you had the imams, the teachers, who said what the law is. Remember, in classical Islam, the government didn't make laws. God had given the laws, and the teachers, the law scholars, will tell you what they are. The rulers essentially ruled. They were the executive, so to speak. But the scholars, the imams, the ayatollahs, were not quite like church leaders, more like lawyers or church leader come law professor. And they would criticize the government or support it and whatever. And it was always important that they made sure the government was properly Islamic. But the idea that they would actually run the thing themselves, that's new. I don't think it's happened before in Shiite history. So the actual takeover by, so to speak, the clergy of a regime, Iran is quite unusual and revolutionary. So that's the fourth major movement. As I say, these are not the only movements around, but they are the ones which are the most powerful. Occasionally they fight, occasionally they cooperate. To a large degree, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Wahhabis have come together. Osama bin Laden, even what we call Al-Qaeda, to some degree, is coming together. Because Zawahiri's background is in the Brotherhood out of Egypt. Osama bin Laden's background is in Al-Qaeda or the Wahhabi movements. And they've come together and cooperated. The terrorist movements represent many of these things coming together. Then the people out of Pakistan with Maududi, you see those coming together, and you actually see them now on the literally, physically together on the Pakistani border. So that's with the terrorists, with the radicals, and more generally, there are these and other movements. But my great concern is, as I read the world right now, while radicals are not a majority of Muslims, they do have the momentum. One reason for this is most Muslims don't have an agenda. I mean, they're not actually trying to be radical or trying not to be radical, but getting about their business. And remember, most Muslims don't understand a word of Arabic. So on one level, the Muslim world is, you could do an analogy of, it's like Christianity in Europe in 1300. And you say, what do Muslims believe about their faith? Often the answer is, not very much. Because they don't understand it. It would be like going into a village in Germany in 1300 and asking for a theological discussion. Well, I don't know. I mean, the priests speak Latin. The only Bible around is in Latin, and you don't understand a word of Latin. So you really don't know. You have a few things, and the priest tells you something, you believe it. So at this level, much of Islam is up for grabs. Most